this year has been slower than everybody anticipated. I think the other lenders, my other colleagues that I talk to on a daily basis, they're slow. Everybody, the transactions just aren't happening yet. I think there was a feeling that there was going to be more distress in the market at this point in time in the cycle, and it just hasn't happened yet. And I'm sure you're hearing that from everybody. From our perspective, I think it's still coming. I think there's still a lot out there.
Hi, I'm Gordon Lanphier, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, the podcast that interviews key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping real estate and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Brian Good. Brian is the CEO of iBorrow, a commercial real estate lender that covers a wide variety of asset classes. On the podcast, we discuss distressed assets, the evolving landscape of industrial office and retail, and we dive into how migration patterns and creative destruction are shaping a post-2020 world. If you're interested in multifamily, retail, office, or industrial, it's well worth a listen.
Hey, Brian, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So before we start, why real estate?
Why not? What's wrong with it? It's great. It's always perfect. It's so easy to do. You make a lot of money. There's never a problem. Why not?
So why not law? I mean, you started out in law. Why do you pursue the real estate path?
I think it was very evident from anybody I worked for as a lawyer that was not a long-term profession for me. I think I was just wired differently. I was wired to not sit down at my desk and do research or sit and read documents all day. I think that was just from the start not a good thing for me. I was just thrown into real estate when I was when I started practicing. It was 1996, and the market was kind of in an upswing, and they were looking for young associates in the first firm I worked for, and they just happened to have an opening in the real estate department. I was better with numbers. It was probably the least legal of any of the departments I could be in. Litigation being probably the worst match for me, but with real estate, it was exciting. There was these closings, there were these deadlines, there were people you're interacting with. There were, you know, financial statements that I had access to with respect to certain properties they were buying. I was working for a firm that represented a large REIT in California, an office REIT. It was called Arden Realty. And I had a relationship with the CEO and the president of that company prior to my becoming a lawyer. So it was actually a really nice way for me to work and learn. And so our clients were really good teachers in some respect, and they would teach me about what they were working on, and they would take the time to sit down and tell me to put the documents away and let me just tell you what we're working on. It'll give you a better perspective. So I was able to get sort of a broader view of the real estate world. And it was at a time when these companies that were publicly traded real estate companies, the REITs, were really starting to shine. The first transaction I worked on was with the seller was Sam Zell, who was, you know, a legendary real estate guy. And I got a chance to meet him and sit down with him. And you know, he was very matter of fact. He thought everybody should be in real estate, and he thought it was a good match. And I think he was a reform lawyer as well. So it was nice to talk to him. And then, you know, I was, as a young junior, I was brought into the closings on these transactions. A lot of them were very complicated with a lot of institutional buyers and sellers, and finance partners and joint venture partners. And so I was able to meet a lot of interesting people, which I probably wouldn't have otherwise met if I was a litigator or was stuck in the library. So I really learned a lot in about 2.5 years that I was practicing.
So I'm a reformed lawyer as well. But one of the things that I find interesting is people who kind of started outside of the profession, or at least kind of on the outskirts and moved in. Often it's because they saw a lot of deals as a lawyer or in construction. And I'm curious, since I think you've seen a lot of deals over your career, what does an attractive or a good deal look like?
Well, I mean, I've been on a lot of different sides of a transaction. I've bought properties, I've sold properties, I've been a lawyer on transactions, and now I've the last 12 years, I really focused on lending to transactions. And I think what's attractive to me is if you sit down and if there's basically an intention between all the parties to get something done, I think that's a positive. That always makes things a little easier. If there's sort of a buyer who's searching, they like the property, but they may not have the means to buy it. I think that's, you know, in some circles that's valued. It wastes a lot of time. So I think that I've learned that over the years. But I think I like working with people that have had experience. They've done this before. And they really can, when negotiating, they can cut to the crux of the matter and not waste time. And I think that for me, that's always beneficial. You know, someone wants to sell, someone wants to buy, you need to have two interested parties that want a transaction to happen. And if the buyer is comfortable with their purchase price when they go in, they're not looking at it as a, yes, we've signed a contract and it's the first offer and I'm going to renegotiate, and they have that intent going in. If that's not the case and it's really legit on both sides, I think it's really exciting. It's a wonderful business to be in, to see what's really not mentioned enough is there is creativity in this business. There are people that see things differently. There are people that make educated guesses, and sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong, but they're willing to take that risk, and they're really willing to put it all out on the line. And I think that's what's exciting for me to see. And then from another perspective, I think as I've gotten older, with respect to creativity, I really like seeing new structures and how people work the transaction, whether they use options to buy something or they have different type of lending structures, or their loan has different structures that I hadn't seen before. I'm always open to learning new structures like that. And I think that's what keeps it exciting for me.
Can you tell me one of those creative lending structures that you've seen used? Because I know we're in a, I wouldn't say super low liquidity market, but it's definitely lower than it has been in the past. Can you talk a little bit about that creativity?
Sure. So I think a lot of what I've done over the years is try to incorporate my experience in how do we transact. And I think one of the things we've done, and just turning to our lending company, iBorrow, we are able to do transactions that a lot of people aren't. And I think it has to do with the experience that I've had and my partners have had with respect to owning properties, being on Wall Street, seeing corporate deals and how they're looked at. I think, for example, we're traditionally a non-recourse lender. So we don't look for personal guarantees in order to enhance the credit and enable us to lend more money. If someone offers up a full guaranteed repayment, we'll take it, but that doesn't go towards our underwriting. But we have transactions where you can look at something where it's a value add play, where a buyer may be buying an empty building, which has a lot of risk to it, but they have tenants in tow, whether it's on the industrial side, the retail side, whatever, and they have a real good credit tenant in tow. And they think that, and they've signed a lease with that tenant. Now the seller may not know that. So the buyer's buying this building, and basically once that tenant moves in, they're going to make a lot of money on the transaction because they're adding value. We will, in those kind of cases, those leases will review. And typically, even if it's a credit tenant, they'll have outs in those leases and contingencies. So the borrower may say, you know, I've got this new lease, I got this tenant in tow, but when you drill down and look at the transaction, they don't deliver the property for whatever reason by a certain date, that tenant can walk. So that's a risk. So in those circumstances, we will sort of make it a non-recourse transaction, but we'll have a limited guarantee on the borrower until, in fact, that tenant moves in and occupies the space and pays rent. And then we can waive that kind of recourse provision. And I think, you know, CMBS won't do that. Banks won't do that. Life companies have struggled with that. But bridge lenders have the flexibility and the creativity to do that. And we've done that on multiple transactions, and it's enabled us to get the transaction. And I think that's helped us. I think one of the other things we allow for is release provisions within our loan documents. So for buyers that are buying portfolios and they're looking to sell and sort of pare back on what they bought, if they have a loan from a CMBS or a life company, they're not able to sell some parts of the collateral. Those lenders don't want to give up the collateral without being paid off in full. we're okay underwriting each asset specifically. So if they sell one or two or three, they can pay us down enough that we'll stay in the deal and we'll still feel comfortable with the coverage. So those are a couple of things that we can get really creative on.
So being creative is great, but ultimately it comes down to hard assets, right? And so when we're doing a deal and we're looking at a deal, the most important thing is finding that asset. So what are you starting to see out in the market in terms of great asset classes as we move into 2025? What are kind of the asset classes you see the most successful deals focused on? And if you were recommending somebody going out and looking at the market, kind of what does a lender see as kind of a positive asset class?
Yeah, it's an interesting time right now, to say the least. I think this year has been slower than everybody anticipated. I think the other lenders, my other colleagues that I talk to on a daily basis, they're slow. Everybody, the transactions just aren't happening yet. I think there was a feeling that there was going to be more distress in the market at this point in time in the cycle, and it just hasn't happened yet. And I'm sure you're hearing that from everybody. From our perspective, I think it's still coming. I think there's still a lot out there. So, you know, one of the things I see is if you're a buyer and you're looking for some sort of distress, it's some sort of transactional, you know, gateway to what you want to do, I think talking to other private lenders in the market and seeing what they have are having problems with and trying to work out a transaction, that's probably your best bet. I think banks, regional banks and larger banks, if they have problems with their portfolio, they're going to sell them in bulk and they're going to sell them to an institution. And for the most part, that's, you know, 2% of the buyers out there. The 98% of the buyers out there aren't going to have that accessibility. So going to other lenders, other private lenders, and talking to them and seeing what they may want to get rid of and sell, that's the first thing. And then maybe I think what else is kind of a good method is to talk to them and try to get in there and figure out how they're financed. A lot of these private lenders are financed with lines of credit, repo lines, et cetera, that are kind of frozen. And if they can find out that they're frozen, then they're going to have to shed assets, and then they're going to have to shed assets and sell notes at a discount. And I think that's a better pathway than going to talk to, you know, Bank of America and seeing if they have any notes they want to sell. I just think that's a dead end. But talking, there's a lot of private lenders out there. They're all visible. They've all made bad loans and or loans they want to get rid of. And I think that's a good pathway. In terms of asset classes, Gordon, I think...
And I'd like to get you off real quickly, because we have a story within our own portfolio where there was something like that occurred, where we tried to reach out because there was an asset that was a toxic asset, and we tried to reach out to a large bank and they didn't want anything to do with this. And we ended up having to buy it on the market just in general, because it was a great asset. But we've worked with private lenders in the past doing that process, and they've been phenomenal. So sometimes institutional size and scale can be like an absolute hindrance towards getting not only a profitable deal done on both sides, but just a deal done at all. So I think that's phenomenal advice that you get.
Often I do give advice. My wife says sometimes once in a while I've given good advice, but yeah, I think that's a helpful track to go down.
And then in terms of asset classes, what are you seeing in asset classes that are seen as at least positive from the lender side?
Well, it's interesting. Retail, I think, is a little bit stronger right now. And I don't know if that's it's because independently, it's just a better asset class than it was 10 years ago. Not everybody believes that the internet is just going to take over all retail. I think that's come back, and it's actually a strong asset class. I think when it's paired next to office, it looks amazing, because office is just so beaten up. I think that, you know, within office, it's obvious that you've got downtown central business district kind of office buildings that they're older, they're just not going to get leased. There's suburban office buildings that are going to have problems. The ones that are newer and amenitized, they're going to survive. So that's kind of where office is shaking out. I think industrial, you know, on the fringe has had a little bit of softness to it, but overall it's handling everything pretty well. For some reason, I think that's still a very, very strong asset class. I think the one that could go either way is multifamily. I think multifamily values are down. You know, we're in 32 states, so we see a lot of data on multifamily. I mean, for the most part, 30 to 40% value decrease over the last couple of years. And I think that that's, if you're okay buying something with some negative leverage and are okay, you know, taking on some of the lease up risk and your money's more patient, I think that that over time, over the next 5 to 10 years, you'll be rewarded with that kind of market on the multifamily side. I think the whole rage towards data centers, I don't get it. I think it's so expensive to build those kind of properties that it takes so much capital. You know, I don't see it becoming that mainstream. I think the outdoor storage market, you know, kind of this new asset class that was created, I think it's a lot of smaller transactions that kind of make that up. And I don't think that that's going to ever become this huge kind of new asset class. I think it's always going to be a subclass of industrial. I love cold storage. I think cold storage is got so many attractive qualities to it. You've got barriers to entry. Yeah.
And so what are those qualities? Because in our market, cold storage is hotly in demand, but at the same time, there's not a lot of it getting built. So what are you seeing in the cold storage world?
Well, that's the barrier to entry. It's hard to build. It's expensive, but there are tenants clamoring for it all the time. The demand is so pent up. There's a few people that have cracked the code in terms of cold storage that are kind of dominating the field. There was a company that went public a few months ago that just blew everybody away in a bunch of cold storage, and the demand was out there. So I think if you can kind of figure out more efficient way to build those, I think you have to go into areas that aren't as, I mean, try to build a cold storage in Santa Monica, it's not going to happen. But if you want to build a cold storage sort of outside Denver or outside Chicago or something like that, I think you have a better chance of creating a business model that works and is viable. You know, I think hedging everybody's bets, I think industrial, all certain divisions within industrial does really, really well. And I think it will continue. I think multifamily is kind of that risk reward thing that people may want to look into. And I think take all that out, the property types, you really have to focus more and more on the areas with which you're buying. So I'm talking about geography. So I mentioned it. I mean, California is a very difficult place to buy, and it's a very difficult place to operate. And, you know, there's a handful of cities and states like that around the country that I think are very detrimental to entrepreneurial real estate. I think that that's a problem. Even places like within Texas, like Austin's difficult to build. I've spent a lot of time there, and people are complaining about permitting and those kind of things. And it's tough because you're within a state that's viewed as very pro business, very pro entrepreneur, very pro landlord. So you've got to really do your homework and figure out with respect to, once you've figured out the property type that you're interested in, do the research and figure out what's the city and the areas you want to go into.
How do you determine that typically in, when you're talking about the cities and the areas that are hot versus not?
Right. Do you have to do your... It's more than just looking on the internet and figuring out, you know, what it's a lot. This business is still at its core very much relationship driven. So when I'm in these cities visiting, when we're lending money, you know, the ultimate outcome is to get repaid. So we do a lot of research and spend a lot of time with the brokers in the area, local council, talking to people about projects and what were the impediments to getting it done. And I think you just have to spend time on the ground and figure it out. And I think that there is, you have to figure out the trends. So certain cities are getting, you know, Nashville's always been considered a really easier type place to build and develop. And I think Austin used to be considered that way, and now it's trending not to be. So you've got to kind of look at that and figure out what kind of risk you're willing to take. Las Vegas, always considered a wonderful place to build, tons of land, et cetera. And now they're clamping down because of water issues and city versus county issues and things like that. And so your experience, you know, visiting the locations, talking to people, that'll give you sort of an idea. And then you look at sort of demographics. Who's moving there? Are companies moving there? Are they running? Are people moving there? Are there school, how's the school district? You know, that those kind of things, I think those all go into factors when you determine where you want to sort of create your portfolio.
Dive in and talk a little bit more about multifamily. I know you mentioned that it was a risk reward asset class, and you mentioned softening within the asset class. Where do you see the softening primarily? Is it market driven? Is it asset class driven? Where is that, you know, tender softness?
So it's definitely supply demand issues. I think that's where you get softness. In certain Sunbelt cities, they just overbuilt. And I think what happens is everybody kind of sees the same demographics. Oh my God, there's so many people moving there. We need to build. And so they overbuilt. It's just kind of the swarm mentality. And so there is too much product in these Sunbelt cities. Specifically Phoenix, which we spent a lot of time in, there's just too much. And over time, the demand will catch up with the supply. But it's definitely in cities that like that, like Denver, Austin, other places within Texas too, Florida, a lot of different parts of Florida, Carolinas, Charlotte, those kind of places, it's just overbuilt. And I think it's a great place. A lot of these places are considered great places to live, great places to move to, great tax benefits. But for now, in the immediate future, it's soft. So you're seeing concessions given, you know, 1 month free, 2 months free on rent. You're seeing places where, you know, they're incentivizing brokers to bring people to lease it up, whether it's residential or commercial side. So you're seeing all those kinds of things happening. And that's to me, that's a good sense of, you know, okay, from a contrarian perspective, it's not a bad time. If you can get a big enough discount on a purchase price, then it's okay to look in there and start buying.
So if we talk about opportunities and distress, there's few things that over the last 20 years have maybe been as distressed as malls. And so I'm curious, I've heard you talk about and mention in articles about malls and distressed mall assets, but there's also opportunity there. So do you think there's opportunity potentially in mall retail, or are we just, you know, throwing money down a hole?
So you're talking about enclosed kind of those older looking malls, those behemoths that are everywhere. I heard a statistic. I used to be when I was on the buy side, I was doing a lot of shopping centers, a lot of retail. We never did enclosed malls, but it was fascinating that I think the statistic was there's 1200 regional malls in the country. And when I say regional malls, like bigger, you know, department store anchored kind of things, 1200 of them in the country. Within 5 to 10 years, 800 of them would be needing to be knocked down and change of use. 800 out of the 1200, and 400 would survive. And I think it's probably, we've been approached from our lender side. We have been approached to, refinance or give acquisition financing to a lot of those regional malls. And everybody comes in with a plan. We're going to, you know, Macy's is vacating or Sears is vacating. We're going to turn it into self storage. We're going to turn it into multifamily. We're going to do this, that, and the other. And the problem is you have to get a lot of approval from the city that you're in. And then you also have to have that could take years depending on what you want to do. So do you want to change it to multifamily? Everybody needs housing. So then you're talking about, okay, now do we want affordable within that multi-housing? What's the composition of the housing going to be? Then what do we do with the other empty space? Do you want to live in an apartment, which is right next to a self-storage facility or an industrial building or retail that's being knocked down? So will there be a bit demand there for that? So it's really putting together a new puzzle for that property. And as a lender, do I want to be a part of that? And do I want to, you know, I'm a short-term bridge lender, 2 to 3 years, when this is 3 to 5 to 10 year kind of stuff. This is transformational change of use, you know, adaptive reuse. This is stuff that sometimes needs city referendums and not just neg decks. They need a whole entire environmental report done, a whole EIR with comments, and they may need, you know, more utilities. So it's a really big play, and I don't think the lending community is set up for that. I think longer term financing for adaptive reuse is not really what's out there. I mean, CMBS and life companies want a use. They want something that's in place. They don't want to wait around. Construction lenders, they want some sort of goal. They need to have a means to an end so they know they're going to get out within a certain specific time. And if you're buying a property, even if it's an enclosed mall, and it has some cash flow, you don't know which direction it's going. And I think that's what's hard to pull from the financing perspective. So then you're left with, okay, so how do I put a capital stack together for some sort of amorphous plan to change the use of this retail mall? Now you need an institutional kind of partner, you know, with big pockets. You're talking state, you know, investment type group. And, you know, I don't know about you, but if you don't have a certain plan in mind, it's very hard to attract that capital. And if you don't have the experience of doing it before, it's very hard to attract that capital. So I think a lot of these regional malls are going to stay where they are for the near future. I think people can, you know, buy them very cheap. They can get cash flow from them because they'll lease it up to, you know, five different jewelers and four different shoe retailers, and maybe have a Macy's or somebody like that still there paying rent, and so they can cover what they need to cover. But to me, it's really a puzzle, and it takes a lot of time, and I'm not sure the capital partners are there to help make that work.
So let's talk about another asset class where the capital partners are trying to make things work, and that's office, right?
Yeah.
Office is a class that's been struggling. It's been definitely a distressed asset class since 2020. And definitely on everyone's mind are things like conversions or demolitions, or just even just trying to improve them to save potentially distressed assets. What are you seeing in terms of the financing side of office products in the U.S.?
So not seeing a lot of people jumping into it from a finance perspective. I think you really have to be prepared to be an all cash kind of buyer. Excuse me. I think if you've got a very solid office building, and it's cash flowing with leases that are with credit tenants for the most part, and have sort of staggered expiration dates, and you're underwriting it properly, meaning TIs, tenant improvements, leasing commissions are really part of the everyday expenses as recurring, not below the line items. So they're included before you get to the NOI. If you're underwriting it like that, I think there are lenders out there on the newer product with amenitized properties that'll lend you 50 to 60% loan to value. And they can give you rates that are somewhat tolerable. And you're going to be buying these buildings between 7.5 to 9.5 kind of cap rates. You know, then there's positive leverage, and I think those deals will pan out. There's also people out there that are office kind of distressed buyers that are willing to give you preferred equity on those kind of deals. Last dollar in, riskiest money for, you know, 15 to 20%, because they're going to take the risk that they're going to be owning the property and they like their basis. So I think there are certain transactions that will take place. It's really, truly a basis play. It is, you know, something was $400 or $500 a foot. Now it's $50 to $100 a foot. I think people get interested. The question becomes, how do I finance it? And then how do I make money on it? I think the key on office buildings, which people need to appreciate, is also you can't really mothball an office building. If you mothball it and close it up, to turn it back on is going to cost you a lot of money. The infrastructure within an office building is meant to be consistently on and not to be turned off. So you're going to have more costs. So you have to keep it up and running. And which means if it's vacant, you're going to have to pay expenses on a building and try to attract new tenants. I think that's problematic. So, but all those factors, I do hear a lot of people going into it. They're dipping their toes. They're looking at the basis and they're looking at the quality of the building.
We've had success with some distressed assets in the office world, but it's all about buying at an extremely low price, right?
Correct. Right.
And, I'm not sure that there's enough humility yet in the office market to, on average, make deals pencil, but there will be eventually. But one of the things that I'm interested, particularly from the lender side, is how a deal would pencil on a potential conversion. If you've seen office conversions from the lender side and kind of how you would see that being financed.
So this is also very interesting because when I started my career in 96 as a lawyer, offices were in vogue. Office buildings were getting premiums. Publicly traded companies specializing in office were getting premiums, and now it's kind of not happening. So the question is conversions, and how does that play into a lender's perspective? And I think they were getting a lot of these office to resi conversions were getting a lot of publicity, and not a lot of them were actually happening. I think there was, you know, fewer than 100 happening nationwide at some point. I don't know what the number is now, but you've got to realize a couple of things. If you're going to convert an office building, you got to make sure it's going to be vacant. Okay. You got to make sure it's zoned or will be zoned to be converted. So you won't have any problem with that. And then you got to look at the nature of the building. You've got to have bigger floor plates, so older buildings. And then I'm not a developer per se. I've done some development, but I mean, you give me a hammer and I don't know which end to use. But there's something to me that says, like, if I'm converting a building where in each floor you have two bathrooms and now you need to have 30 bathrooms, there's some sort of infrastructure issue that's going to cost a lot of money to fix. So you take all that together and then you say, okay, I did convert it. What is this building going to look like? And a lot of the conversions I've seen are really weird looking buildings if I was a tenant, you know, you have weird corners, you have weird lighting. It just doesn't, it's a weird looking sort of Jenga puzzle. And so to me, and the lobbies are dark and some of them are not great. So what are you getting out of this? Yes, you're satisfying some utility because there's going to be a use for multifamily. But if you're spending all this money to convert and spending all this time, you better have a building that leases up and is attractive and over the long term will be that way. And I think that still remains to be seen. I think still, if you build something from scratch, it's going to look a lot better. So your competition, you have to see that. So I think there's a long way to go. I think it's a valid effort that everybody's putting into trying to do this. I think there's a need for housing, and I think office to housing makes a lot of sense. But from a efficiency standpoint and idiosyncratic standpoint, it's very difficult to see how these things are going to work into some sort of prolonged business of doing it.
Let's look at the prolonged big picture, as you just mentioned. In terms of the big picture, the biggest picture that everyone's talking about in the real estate world is migration patterns, right? And how people are moving in the country. And you're seeing there's this vast shift, particularly since 2020. And from a lender, what are you seeing in terms of how that's influencing how you look at a deal and how you look at the viability of a lot of projects?
I think it's become paramount. I think it's the number one or number two issue on everything that we do. To look at California and have it, you know, the last couple of years not grown as a state, that people are actually net leaving the state, is from someone who's born and raised third generation Los Angeles, that's scary. That's kind of a scary thing. And I think it's going to affect everything that's going on in the state. People are moving to the Sunbelt cities and people are moving away from cold areas and California. So they're trying to move to places that are more business friendly, hopefully for families, you know, public schools, better public schools, just better, safer places to live. And I think that has become paramount for us when we look at different projects. I think for sure that's a big issue. I think the other issue, just to add on to what you're talking about in terms of migration, is insurance costs. I think you're looking at another major hurricane running through Florida in the next day or two, where they're still recovering from one, you know, less than 2 weeks away. That to me doesn't signal a fluke. That seems more of a pattern. And I think if the insurance costs are not going to come down or normalize anytime soon. So these are bigger issues. So when you have, so then you have to make a judgment decision. We like Florida to lend it, but do we like it with these insurance costs that are coming up? Is that going to impede business in those states? You know, you can get insurance in Arizona. You can get it in Texas. Can you get it in California and Florida? Can you get it in New York? So those are the kind of things that are playing to it. But I think the migration patterns are definitely paramount. I think there are, you know, for us, we're always looking for from an underwriting perspective to get ahead of the curve and try to figure out where people are going to move and where the people are going to do business, because it helps us plan for the future in terms of where we're going to lend money. And I think that that it's definitely from a 5 to 10 year perspective, I would much rather lend in a state that has a positive migration pattern versus somebody that's kind of falling by the wayside.
I'm curious what you're seeing on top of just plainly these large state-based lending patterns and success patterns beyond just that on the even state or regional level, but let's look inside of metro areas. And one of the things that I think that's fascinating has been the move to the suburbs that I've seen with my own practice in Chicago. We've seen a lot of flight from Cook County, and I've had tremendous success moving folks to the collar counties, both in Illinois and in Wisconsin, around the Chicago metro area. And so I'm curious, are you seeing that kind of pattern as well play out in other metro areas? You know, am I just in the Chicago bubble?
So Chicago, by the way, is one of the best leasing markets in the country now. So that was news to me when I saw that. Yeah, I think there is, look at LA, which is where I'm from. Over the last 25 years, there was a big push to move people downtown. So there was condos built downtown. There was Staples Center built downtown. There was, you know, the subways built to come downtown. There's hotels doing, you know, in downtown. All this stuff is coming there. And I think the only thing that's really performing well is hotels in downtown Los Angeles. The condo market's a mess. The crime rates are up. Office is a disaster. You know, so it worked, but then it didn't work in Los Angeles. It's a big problem. Chicago, downtown Chicago's got all sorts of issues. Midtown New York, all sorts of issues. Although, you know, but the suburbs do fine. I mean, if you're in Northbrook or Glencoe or Highland Park, it's doing great. You know,
yeah.
Park, I mean, those things are booming. If you're in downtown LA, you know, if you want to move to Highland Park, Silver Lake, Echo Park, you know, Venice, it's doing fine. All those places are doing fine. So how do you get control of these? And another one, San Francisco, terrible downtown, awful, but if the suburbs aren't bad. So how do you reverse that? Do you want to reverse that? I mean, I think that's the first question is, do you really want to reverse that? And then how do you reverse that? I think there was a very big push in Philadelphia. I was there, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, where they did a whole overlay zone within Philadelphia. And the big thing they did was the police. I mean, you got to have a safe place to live if you want to move downtown. And I think the places that I just mentioned that have bad downtowns are not safe places to live. They're not safe places to walk. They're not safe places to eat. You would never go downtown there, despite the fact, like in Los Angeles, we have Disney Concert Hall. I mean, it's right there. It's a great venue, but you know, I can go Sunday during the day and hear the Philharmonic, but do I want to go to a nighttime show in Disney downtown? I don't think so. You know, do I want to go to Staples? Sure. But do I want to take the train to get to Staples, you know, 7 o'clock on a Friday? I don't know. So those are kind of things that are going to need both city and private partnerships in order to make that all work. And for me, as a citizen and also as an entrepreneur, I want to make sure it's safe. I think that's the key. That's first and foremost. And yes, naturally, if the downtown doesn't work, you're going to expand. You're going to move into the suburbs. And that's where everybody's going to transact. I mean, it's Chicago to me. I've been there a lot, and it's. You go right, you know, there's a couple great hotels downtown, but I like staying with my friends in the suburbs. There just seems to be a lot more to do, and you stay by the lake, or you go into Lincoln Park or something like that, and it's a lot of fun. But being downtown at night, not my idea of fun.
Speaking anything that you wouldn't hear typically from your average Chicagoan.
Yeah.
In terms of safety, though, safety in terms of physical safety, some of it is financial safety. And so we've had a huge shift post 2008 with how people view risk and people view lending. I'm curious, as we look from a lender's perspective before we get to our final four and wrap things up, what are you seeing from the lender's perspective from the post-2008 world and kind of now into how lenders just generally view deals?
I think what lenders are trying to do is, I think the portfolio is mostly industrial multifamily. I think that's really, if you can show 70 to 75% of your book being multifamily and industrial, I think that's the safe play to go. I think for those lenders, and by the way, we're one of them. I mean, it's just, you get a lot less questions. Now, you may not get risk reward. And our role is really not to maximize. I mean, our role is to get consistent risk adjusted returns to our investors. In industrial and multifamily, typically that blend gets you there. If you want to take some risk on the fringes, you go into some hotels and you go into retail. I think retail is probably the safer place to be. And, you know, you stay away from ground up, you stay away from land. But if you're a lender that's looking for 15 to 20%, if you're a institutional private equity fund kind of thing, you're going to have to add some risk there, ground up risk or inexperienced borrower risk or product type risk to your mix. So instead of being 75-25, you may be 50-50. And then you can get your 12 to 15% yield versus your 8 to 10, but you got to understand going in that you're going to have more defaults. You're going to spend more time dealing with issues in your portfolio, and that may take away from the ultimate goal, which is to get the money out as quickly as possible. So those are all the things that we've learned over the last 12 to 13 years of lending money.
That's not too different than what we're seeing from the development and the brokerage side. One of the things that we do like to see is we like to go to our final four and get a little bit more about you and how you view the world. And one of our favorite questions that we like to ask, and this is one we ask every time, is where do you see real estate and lending going 10 years out?
Wow. I mean, we've talked about this maybe a little bit before, but I mean, AI is going to take a huge, huge leap into our businesses. There's no doubt about it. And I think it's going to make us more efficient, hopefully. There's going to be some speed bumps. But if you're a company and you're growing and you're not investing money into AI, you're going to be behind the eight ball and you're going to have to take some lumps with it. It's going to make mistakes. But, you know, I think those people that are graduating college and are going to get into real estate and want to try to find that $100,000, $150,000 job, you know, preparing offering books, when you can pretty much get 90% of it done through an AI program,
yeah,
that's going to be a problem for them. So I think there's going to be less younger people involved in real estate, which I think is a shame. Hopefully those people, if they really have a passion for it, get in more on the entrepreneurial side and start doing projects on their own. And I think that will save them. I'm hopeful that lending gets away from being this sort of stoic old ship. And I think there's more nuanced ways to lend money that are just as effective. I hope that there's somebody that comes up with something like that. I think there's going to be people that figure out the office market and make a lot of money from it, a lot smarter than you and I. They're going to figure out that how offices are going to get redone, reestablished, and how people are going to work differently. I think hybrid work is always going to be here from now on. I don't think that's going to change. I think that's a shame because I think our best days at the office are when everybody's here and we're collaborating and we're more efficient that way. We come up with better ideas and we get rid of bad ideas quicker. So I think all that together, from my perspective, is a shame. And I think we're going to have a generation of people recovering from COVID, young kids like my own, who are still dealing with the aftershocks of having been locked up for 3 years. And I don't think that goes, I don't think that's noticed enough. And I don't think there's enough attention to that kind of side of the business, that there are people out there, a younger generation, who doesn't know how to engage with other people. And from my perspective, my career has all been about relationships, and I'm sure yours is as well. When I was starting the business, if I didn't have the ability to go out and meet with people and talk to them in an educated manner, with some clarity and some intelligence, then I would never have had the business that I've had. So I think that that's going to be addressed. So all these things together, I mean, I still think I'm answering all four of your questions at once, I'm sure, but I think I still love this business. I think there's so much more to come, and I think it's a very good way to spend your day and make money.
So in terms of doubling back and talking about younger folks, we have a lot of and not a lot necessarily, but at least 20% of the podcast is under, you know, 35. There's a large segment that are young analysts and young brokers, some of which are under 25, that are listening to this podcast. If you give them just one little quick bit of advice based on your past, what would it be?
I would say never turn down a meeting. Go to every meeting you can and read everything you can get your hands on. Anything and everything. The more information you can read and learn from other people, the better off you're going to be. And in return, the more you read, the better communicator you're going to be. You're going to be able to write better. You're going to be able to talk to people better. And I think all of that together, for advice to a younger me or a younger you, is get engaged, get involved, meet with people in person. Don't rely on Zoom. Don't rely on emails. Do the work, and you'll be rewarded.
And in terms of reading, what should they read? Is there a book that you would advise them to pick up?
Anything Sam Zell's written, I think he's written a bunch of books. I think those are great. I think Michael Lewis is a great writer. I love reading everything he's written. I read from magazine perspectives. I mean, the general stuff that we like to read, like the Wall Street Journal, but read general. Don't read, if you read the Wall Street Journal, I like reading the other sections. I like reading the sort of pop culture, self-interest kind of stuff. To me, that's interesting. You learn about trends that way. I think the least helpful articles within the Wall Street Journal for a real estate person is to read articles about real estate, because it's typically, it's not at a high level. I think they're kind of dumbed down from some perspective. But I think, you know, there's great stuff like Globe Street and Biz Now that give you really good articles to dive into. And then find an asset class that you like and are interested in, and really go to the next level and dig deep. I think people that specialize in one asset class versus being generalists, I think they end up doing a lot better.
Yeah, I think niching down is a phenomenal bit of advice. In terms of niching down, though, this podcast, the whole goal is to talk to brilliant minds and people who are in the arena.
How did I get on this then?
You know what?
You had an open space. It's okay.
In terms of that, though, we find that the folks that are in the arena really do know the best people to reach out to. And we're curious, who should we reach out to next?
Well, that's a great question. If I said the names, the people would come back and call me. Tell me, I didn't want to do that. I mean, I've had some great mentors in my life. I really have. When I was a lawyer and I was getting out of practicing law, there was a guy named Kent Mouton who just retired. And Kent was a partner in a big law firm for a while, and I worked for him. And then we've maintained a friendship, and we've recently went to lunch again. And he just retired, and he's retiring. He's just a brilliant mind, had a good way about him. And what he did for me, which I'll never forget, is like my second day working for him. I was a second year lawyer. He came into my office with a big box of documents and files. And he said, "Congratulations, you're now a teacher at UCLA Extension." I said, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "Now you're here. I'm retiring from teaching. You're teaching UCLA Extension. You're teaching two classes, building a real estate portfolio and loan originations and workouts. The two topics I knew nothing about. That here's all the stuff, learn it, teach it. There's no better way to learn what you're doing than to teach it." And I really appreciate what he did. And I taught there at UCLA for probably 10 years and really learned a lot. And it was from when you're teaching something, you really need to understand what you're doing. And I was teaching to people that were way older than me and had been through two or three different recessions and cycles. And so it was a great way to learn. But Kent was a good mentor. And a guy named Richard Ziman really paved the way for me for what I do. I tell this story often, but when I was going to law school, I was graduating college. My dad said, "Go talk to Richard." And I talked to Richard, and he said, "I'm selling everything." This was 1992. "Don't get into real estate. I'm selling everything. Go to law school." Okay. So I go to law school and I get out of law school and I'm looking for a job. And my dad says, "Go talk to Richard." I go talk to Richard. He says, "I'm buying everything now. Get into law, practice law. I need lawyers. I'm buying everything." So he showed me that there are cycles and there are things, you know, good, bad, and indifferent. And he's been a dear friend for a lot of years and guided me and talked to me. And he's one of the guys where You call him up, you say, I need 20 minutes. He said, come on over. And you end up talking to him for 2.5 hours. And I'm hopeful I can pay that back to other young people, either in my company or not, that are out there, you know, with questions like that. And, you know, I have two young daughters that hopefully they'll try to get in the business, and people will do the same to them that Richard did with me and Kent did with me.
Well, those are two great folks to reach out to. But if someone wants to reach out to you, what's the best way that they can get in touch?
You can always email me, Brian@iBorrow.com. I've done a lot of mentorship at UCLA, and I've talked to a lot of different people. And for Northeastern and my other undergrad, UCSB and Loyola Law School, you know, I get people contact me all the time. So Brian@iBorrow.com. I'm always available. I'll get back to you. Happy to chat.
Brian, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast, and we have to have you on in the future.
It's been great. Thank you so much for the invite. I really had a great time. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thanks again to Brian. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanfear with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.